The book for today's class is, well, class, book club. This is the first time I ever did a book club. My name is Sunyo, by the way. I'm a monk with Ajahn Brahm. I've been living in Bodhinyana nearing 10 years now. I've been a monk for 7, a bhikkhu for 7. And we'll do a book club today on a book by Ajahn Brahm. And it's called Opening the Door of Your Heart. It also goes by some other titles now. What is the other title again? A Truckload of Dung. Oh yeah, that is true. And actually I should have known that that is true because, well, this is the English version. It just has a Bodhi leaf on the front. Yeah, the leaf of the tree that the Buddha sat under during his meditation for his enlightenment. It's a pretty boring cover. The Dutch cover, the Dutch version of the book, I'm Dutch, has a much more interesting cover. Here, have a look. It just has a big pile of dung on the front. And the title is Who Ordered the Load of Dung? Because that's one of the stories, Who Ordered the Load of Dung? And this story goes about somebody who comes back home from work or something and finds in front of their house somebody dumped a whole truckload full of dung, full of cow manure, basically, or whatever manure. And then they get really angry. Ah, who put that dung there? And they try and find out, go calling everybody about the dung, getting really upset, telling their colleagues and their wife all about the dung. And for weeks they get really, really angry about the dung. But all the while, the dung is still in front of their house, so their garden's still stinky, and they still have to smell all the dung all the time. But another person also finds a truckload of dung in front of their house, and instead of getting angry and upset and telling everybody about it, what do? They just... Yeah, they just get the shovel and start digging the dung and using it as manure for their garden, as fertilizer. And of course the person who got all angry and upset, they still have to deal with all the dung, while the person would just start digging the dung, basically, gets rid of it. And that is the same with the problems we have in life. Of course, nobody wakes up and finds a load of dung in front of their house. I hope not anyway. Unless maybe you live in some rural area and the neighbor farmer needed to dump their dung. That usually won't happen. But we've got our own problems in life. Our own metaphorical dung, you know. Maybe some problems with in our minds or whatever. And one thing you could do is complain about it. And that never really helps. And the other thing you can do is start digging the dung. Start working on your problems and your issues. And when you actually work with your problems, it's like you use it as manure for your garden, for your mental garden. You work on your problems in life. It's like you're fertilizing your mind. And that's when you grow beautiful. Like you grow beautiful flowers from manure. You grow a beautiful mind from problems in life. The problems in life always gives us opportunities, basically. And this is always... All these stories, actually, in the book, you can look at them in so many ways. And many of them actually have a link with meditation as well. And the one about the dung, especially, is very useful, I find. Also to use as a reflection in meditation, because sometimes you sit and meditate and your mind may be a bit restless or just thinking too much, or you might be tired or whatever problems you have in meditation. They're like dung in a way in your mind. And a very natural reaction is to react like the person who gets angry with the pile of dung. And you're like, ah, you shouldn't be meditating. You maybe let's say you get really restless or whatever. Oh, I shouldn't be restless. Why am I so restless? Quiet down, mind. I'm always restless. And that attitude doesn't never work. You just get more annoyed and restless. Instead, I had that earlier today. Just realize, oh, this is just this state of mind that I have to learn from right now. This is what I have to work with, basically. So this is actually the perfect mind state for me right now to have, because this is exactly what I need to learn about. Does that make any sense? You have that mind state for a reason, because that is basically where you are at that point in your life and your meditation practice. So you start digging the dung basically of your meditation, and you're just happy to have that mind state in a way, because that is the opportunity to learn. And then you learn and use it as dung for your garden. So that's one of those stories that I really like, actually. It's been a long time since I read the book first. I can't remember when I read it first. I think it must have been when I just arrived in the monastery. And it's very popular book, actually. It's been translated in many languages as well. This is actually the reason that I have the Dutch one, because whenever a publisher publishes a new version of a book or does a new print, they usually send the author a couple of copies as well to share around. And now Ajahn Brahm got this box full of Dutch versions of the book just a week or two ago. And I was the only Dutch person that he could give it to. I know one or two other Dutch persons here in Australia. Yeah, this is going to be a present for somebody in the Netherlands when I go visit them. They may be watching, so I won't say who it is, but secret. But if any other Dutch people are watching and they live here, there may be more copies of the Dutch version in the library. Maybe you can even get them for free, because Ajahn Brahm got the box. No more? They're all gone already, I hear. Okay, excellent. But yeah, the first time I read it must have been the first time I got in the monastery, and hadn't read it since. But these stories are a staple in Ajahn Brahm's talks. I was reading them, and many of them, I only had to read the first half of a paragraph, and then I already knew. Oh, that story. Okay, next one. Oh, that story. I know that. So I read the book in like half a day or whatever. I read it again because I could skip so much. But it's a very nice stories anyway, and still very popular book. I had to get the reference book actually from the library in the monastery, because all the reference section is the section of the books that just stay in the library usually, and we don't take them out. There's actually only a few books in there, but all the normal books were gone anyways. The one that you could usually borrow, so I took the reference one with permission of the librarian, of course. So it's a lot of stories actually that I liked, and I made a few quick notes. Maybe I'll share a few more thoughts about stories and about these stories, how they relate to me and why I like them. And then maybe after that I can invite you to do the same, some of you. Maybe you can think about that if you feel like that, for those who have read the book, or you just can just share any thoughts really. But first of all, the title story, Opening the Door of Your Heart, is based on Ajahn Brahm's experience with his father. That one time his father drove him in the car and just stopped somewhere on a random parking space and said, son, the door of my house is always open to you. Let me see, what page is this story? Yeah, it's page 26, actually. 20, oh, that's another story, actually. Anyway, his father said, "Son, the door of my house is always open to you." 25. And at first, Ajahn Brahm, when he was still a boy, didn't really think of it much. I thought it was just a normal statement, but later he realized that, here it is, he said, "My father was offering unconditional love." So basically he meant, "Son, whatever you do in life, know this, the door of my heart will always be open to you, instead of the door of my house." And when I read that story, I realized my father once did exactly the same thing. And it's so nice, actually, to reflect on it like that, that it actually is when my father was also saying, he said it somewhat differently, actually. Me and my father, I can't remember how old I was, maybe about 12 or 13 or whatever. It must have been the time that as a teenager you start rebelling a bit and you start doing stupid stuff. That's when also my father once said to me, "Whatever you do, you can always come back home here." And at the time, as a young boy, I also didn't really think of it much. But this was also a statement of, my heart will always be open to you, basically. And I feel really grateful that my father said that to me, because I already knew that, in a way, that I would always be welcome in his house, but he also welcomed me, basically, in his heart. Sometimes it's just, he probably can't remember telling me that. Sometimes it's just these tiny things that people say to you, and if you reflect on them in a certain way, they can just really inform your life. And I think this was the same day that my father said something else that I never really forgot, because he told me this about, "You can always come back home." For some reason, he told me that while we were visiting the grave of my brother — I used to have a older brother, but he died when I was about 5 years old. I still remember him, but he had a sickness when he was born, and so he passed away. And he was, he had a sickness that was really quite hard for him. Couldn't absorb certain nutriments or something. I never knew the official name of it, but so he had development issues. And my father, that day when we were visiting the grave, also said, he said, it's something like, maybe it's also not bad that he passed away, in a way. It's maybe good, in a way. And as a young person, you never think about life and death much, of course, but somehow that sort of opened the door for me in my mind, that usually we think about death as only a bad thing. Like, when somebody dies, everybody always usually thinks it's bad, especially when it's a young person who dies. But my father sort of thought about it when you're really sick, and if you then pass away, maybe it's not so bad, in a way. So it's like changing your perspective. Yeah. I don't know if he believed in life after death at that point, because my family wasn't really especially religious in any official way, but I also think my brother now, he's in a much better place than he was while he was still in that sick body. That's something else I learned from my father on that same day that he said the door of his house was always open for me as well. And there's also some stories about death in this book as well, but let's make it more fun. Why talk about death? I don't feel like talking about death today. One story I really like is about the monks in the cave. Who remembers the story of the monks in the cave? Seven monks were in a cave, yeah. Maybe I'll read it out, actually. Isn't that a standard part of a book club, that you read a passage? So this is on page 26, actually, the story directly following the one about the opening the door of your heart. And this is actually called Opening the Door of Your Heart. That's why I was confused earlier. Several centuries ago, seven monks were in a cave in a jungle somewhere in Asia, meditating on the type of unconditional love I described in the previous story. That was the love that his father gave him. There was the head monk, that's number one, his brother, and his best friend. That's three monks. The fourth was the monk's enemy. They just could not get along. The fifth monk in the group was a very old monk, so advanced in years that he was expected to die at any time. The sixth monk was sick, so ill in fact, that he too could die at any time. Actually, now this story is about death all of a sudden again. Oh, well. Sorry? Yeah, you can't escape it. Yeah. That's true in many ways. Apparently, we can't get even away from the subject. Anyway, that was the sick monk was the sixth monk was the sick monk. And the last monk, the seventh, was the useless monk. Every monastery has one of those. Or multiple, maybe. But we will see that they are just as respected as any other monk. He always snored when he was supposed to be meditating. I've heard people snore during Ajahn Brahm's talks as well in the monastery, so it does happen also. He couldn't remember his chanting. And if he did, he would chant off-key. He couldn't even keep his robes on properly. Well, that he shares with Ajahn Brahm. I don't feel ashamed about saying that, because Ajahn Brahm actually mentioned that during his talk last week himself, or not yesterday himself. But the others tolerated him and thanked him for teaching them patience. One day, a gang of bandits discovered the cave. It was so remote, so well hidden, that they wanted to take it over as their own base. So they decided to kill all the monks. The head monk, fortunately, was a very persuasive speaker. He managed, don't ask me how, to persuade the gang of bandits to let all the monks go except one, who would be killed as a warning to all the other monks not to let anybody know the location of the cave. So they were, he said, just kill one of us and that is enough, that we won't tell anybody. That was the best the head monk could do. He couldn't talk them out of killing them all. The head monk was left alone for a few minutes to make the awful decision of who should be sacrificed so that the others could go free. And then Ajahn Brahm is now speaking. When I tell this story in public, I pause here to ask my audience, well, who do you think the head monk chose? So who did they choose? Did they choose the head monk? Who did they choose to be killed? The head monk? Themselves? The brother? The best friend? the enemy, the old monk, the sick monk, or the useless monk? Who do you think he chose? Maybe somebody who hasn't heard this story before. Oh, we've all heard this story before. Oh, well, that's pretty boring. So, okay, so who do you think it was? Yes, well. You think the head monk. Well, let me continue reading here then. Some suggest the enemy, but Ajahn says no. Some suggest the brother is also wrong. The useless monk always gets a mention. How uncharitable we are. And then Ajahn says, writes, once I have had my bit of fun, I reveal the answer. Drum roll. The head monk was unable to choose. His love for his brother was exactly the same, no more and no less than the love for his best friend, which was exactly the same as his love for his enemy, for the old monk, the sick monk, and even for the dear old useless monk. He had perfected the meaning of those words, the door of my heart will always be open to you, whoever you are, whatever you do. The door of the head monk's heart was wide open to all, with unconditional, non-discriminating, free-flowing love. And most poignantly, his love for others was equal to his love for himself. The door of his heart was open to himself as well. That's why he couldn't choose between himself and others. Why is it that most in my audience thought that the head monk would choose himself to die? Why is it in our culture that we always sacrifice ourselves for others and this is held to be good? Why is it that we are more demanding, critical, and punishing of ourselves than of anyone else? And of course, this story is about choosing who to die, but that is a bit extreme. You probably will never be in that situation. But it's, of course, again, all, as all stories, it's like a metaphor, a figure. And the point is not to choose ourselves to die over others, but this sentence is more like what it's about. Why is it that we are more demanding, critical, and punishing of ourselves than of anyone else? And that is another thing that I realized also is very applicable also to meditation. Again, these stories, you can always take them further. And often in meditation, you can be so critical of your own mind states, like, oh, I should not be sleepy, I am better than this. And probably all other people in this meditation hall are very awake and enlightened. And I am the one who is sleepy and restless. But we're all critical of ourselves. Whoever sits in a meditation group and thinks, ah, why is that other person so restless? They should not be restless. We're always thinking of ourselves in meditation. And about a week or so ago, I gave a meditation class for Armadale Group. Don't know if any of you have ever been there, but it's recorded online as well. And then I also spoke on this, actually, that I spoke on I asked the audience a question. Who here is not perfect? Let me ask the question again. Who here is not perfect? Please raise your hand if you are not perfect. Yes, and then everybody raises their hand. All right, very good. Who here allows all the other non-perfect people to be not perfect. Yeah, everybody allows everybody else to be not perfect. So let's say we are here with 20 people. So all the other 19 people allow you, whoever is listening, to be non-perfect. They allow you to have your flaws. But then when we think about ourselves, we often don't allow ourselves our flaws. We allow others to have their flaws. Others allow us to have our flaws. But for some reason, it's so difficult to allow ourselves to have our flaws. And that attitude to not open the door of your heart to your own flaws can be so problematic, actually, because I find when you have like an adverse relationship with your own, even calling them flaws sort of makes it already more than it is, with your own shortcomings, let's say, if you react negatively to them, then they never change for some reason. They always get worse. Get worse and worse. I don't know if that story is in this book. I don't think so, but there is also, maybe it is, the story of the demon that steals the emperor's throne. Is that in this book? It could be. There's another story Ajahn Brahm often tells. There's this ugly demon sits on the emperor's throne, and the guards and all the other palace attendants come to the demon and say, "Get off, you ugly demon, you don't belong on this throne, you shouldn't sit here." And whatever they say or do, the demon just grows bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah, you know this story? And then the king comes back from his travels, and he realizes what's going on. He says, "Oh, hello, demon, nice to meet you. Sit on my throne. Can I give you any food and drink? Are you all right?" And with every kind word, the demon got smaller and smaller and smaller until he got so small that he just disappeared altogether. And that is when we get annoyed with our own shortcomings, our own flaws. They never go away. It just seems that they become bigger and bigger. So yeah, that's what I also talked about during that meditation class. And what I also told them is, why do you get so negative in meditation? Just to sit down and just to be there, you already did everything you needed to do. It's already a success. The meditation has already succeeded the moment you sit down. And I use that attitude myself as well. I don't teach people one thing and do something else myself, because that would be hypocritical. But I use that attitude myself as well in meditation. Just sitting down and then just sit to meditate. And then making the determination that, or determination, the just the realization that just sitting down and to meditate is already, basically the meditation is already a success, it's already done. I don't need to change anymore, reach anything. I don't need to get anywhere. I just need to sit there basically and enjoy that I already succeeded just by sitting down. And that just you can imagine that makes your mind peaceful right away. Because there's nothing to chase after anymore. Nothing to change, nothing to do. So you open the door of your heart to whatever's going on in your mind with that little trick. Maybe try it out one day if you're meditating. Just sit down and just realize that just by being there, you're already complete. Already did everything you needed to do. Let me see if there's any more nice stories. Just made some very brief notes. There's a lot of stories in the book as well, just daily life wisdom. It's probably one of the more famous ones is about the wheelbarrow story. That Ajahn Brahm was working in Thailand, digging for days, putting a pile of earth from one place with wheelbarrows, putting it somewhere else. Yeah, we all know this story. And then Ajahn Thak came back, and when he saw they moved the pile of earth, he told them to move it somewhere else. And Ajahn Brahm got really annoyed about this. Why can't the head monks just make up their mind? And then another monk saw that he got annoyed and told him, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy, but thinking about it is the hard part. And this is a very useful story in any kind of work or thing we have to do in life. It's often so easy just to do it, to think about it. That is always the headache. Giving a book club is easy. I didn't think about it beforehand because I read the book and I thought, oh, it's just like pushing a wheelbarrow is easy. If I think about the book club, it suddenly becomes hard. So this is all I just sort of prepared while I was reading it, but nothing much more. But it's the same thing with many things in life. Actually, something very similar happened to me also once in a monastery, but not with earth, but with mulch. Moving mulch when I was a novice or an anagarika from the monastery to Jhana Grove. We finally had it all on a big pile. And then other monk came and said, oh, move it over there. Exactly the same thing. I thought, is this just maybe a standard thing they do in Buddhist monasteries to test their students out? Is it just a tradition or something? So this tested me as well, because for days we were digging mulch. We were getting so fed up with mulch that at some point me and another monk were just in the morning when we were having our breakfast just before work, we just looked at each other and did just this, mulch, mulch, like we're getting mulch again today. We're getting put on the mulch duty again, mulch. That was all we had to say to know that we were annoyed with mulch. Mulch is, by the way, for people who may be from non-English speaking, it's just wood chips, basically. They put a tree in a big machine and then it turns into all this stuff that you put in the garden or whatever. So we were digging mulch for weeks, actually, and then there was still a lot more to go. And then another day we came there and it suddenly was all spread out throughout all Jhana Grove. You know, maybe some of you have been there, you've got all these gardens around. It's actually most of it, me and some other monks spread all the mulch there. But suddenly it was all spread out. And then we were like, why? What happened? Then Ajahn Brahm said, oh yeah, I ordered the backhoe driver to spread it all out. And he just did it in half an hour. I don't know why you were doing that for weeks. I was planning to get them to spread it out all the time. So he was planning to get the backhoe driver to do all the mulch all this time while we were getting annoyed with mulch. Maybe on purpose. I don't know. Probably not. But it's funny anyway. Yeah, it does. Those kind of things do test you, yeah. Yeah. But still, I was probably not even a monk yet, by the way. I hope that if I would be now spreading mulch for weeks again, I have learned something in the few years. I would not get as annoyed and would not be mulch again. But just, hey, mulch again today. Yeah. Good opportunity. Anyway, that's just some stories. Yeah, some of these stories you can very daily life wisdom. But maybe some others of you would like to speak a bit about some of these stories that for those of you who've read the book or maybe would like to say something else? Oh, sorry, there will be actually a microphone.
Sorry. I think I really like that book because it's very simple and easy to understand. And I think that's kudo to Ajahn Brahm to be able to achieve that.
Yeah, it is written in a very, it's easy stories, but they also go very deep, I feel.
Oh, they are extremely deep too, and you don't realise until you think, oh yes, and then you go away and you think, wow, that is brilliant. Hmm. That's how I find it anyway. I don't know if anybody else does.
What I find most brilliant about the book is when you read the book, it sounds like the life of a monk is really exciting. like we experience all these amazing stories and things. But actually, it's pretty boring. Well, it's not boring in the sense that you're sitting around being bored all the time. But it's not as exciting as the book makes it seem. Let me put it that way. And it's really brilliant that Ajahn Brahm actually takes everyday occurrences and turns them into a story. Like the two bed bricks in the wall, for example. And it could just be something that happened and he never think about it again, but turn it into a story and everybody remembers it now. I just have to say two bad bricks in a wall and most people will know what that story is about. So that's what is actually quite shows a certain skill Ajahn Brahm has to turn ordinary events into stories, actually.
And that's why I feel these short stories and that very simple and very profound.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Venerable.
Anybody else? I have any story to tell. Do you know the story about the angry crocodile? This is a story I heard a month or two ago. I've never told it before. It's a story of some writer. It's not from the Buddhist tales, I don't think. It's like a modern story, but I liked it a lot, so let me tell the story about the angry crocodile. Yes, there's a microphone. I can lean back a bit. There was, in the hot north of Australia, a river. And at this river, all the animals used to go to drink and to bathe. But in the river lived the angry crocodile. And whenever other animals came to the river, the crocodile always went, "Rah! Get away from here, this is my river. You cannot drink my water. You cannot bathe here." And sometimes even, of course, being a crocodile, whenever a nice juicy animal came up to the river, the crocodile will rah, bite them. And yes, that's what they do. Crocodiles, they are very, very, very dangerous. And they would eat the animals. So all the animals got really afraid of going to the river. And they got really thirsty. And all the animals upset with the crocodile. Why is the crocodile such angry crocodile? We need to share the river. All the animals need to drink something. So they all got together and formed meeting groups. What shall we do about the crocodile? Shall we invade the crocodile country and drop Well, I don't think animals have bombs, but... You know, some people like to invade other people's countries. As we know, it's going on in the world right now. So the animals are thinking the same. Shall we destroy the angry crocodile? Throw coconuts at him, maybe, instead of bombs. And what can we do with this stupid crocodile? And while they were all discussing what to do about the angry crocodile, there's a little mouse. And the little mouse did not think about how bad the crocodile was. Had a little look at the crocodile. And then they realized something, the mouse. And when the crocodile was asleep, he would open his mouth while asleep. And the mouse went up to the crocodile and went into the crocodile's mouth. Oh, very dangerous. If the angry crocodile would wake up, the mouse would surely be a goner. But what did the mouse do? He went all the way to the back of the crocodile's mouth, put his arms around one of the crocodile's teeth, and pulled it out. And then the crocodile wake up and said, "Ah, thank you so much, mouse. That tooth has been hurting me for years, and it was hurting me so much that I couldn't help but be angry at everybody. And now you finally solved my problem. I don't have a bad teeth anymore. Ah, oh, please, mouse, come and join the river. Drink in the river. And come, all the animals come too. Because by having their bad teeth removed, the crocodile was no longer the angry crocodile. They were no longer upset. You can imagine if you have a toothache. I don't know if you've ever had one. I'm lucky enough to never have had one, but if you have a toothache, you're going, it's just annoying, and you get more easily annoyed yourself as well. Because you're physically annoyed, you get mentally annoyed more easily. And it was happening to the crocodile. And the moral of the story is, when other people annoy us, when they maybe are partner or your boss or your colleagues, they treat you badly, they say, you this and that, you cannot do this and that, it's always because they have some problem of themselves. May not be a rotten tooth, but some mental problems. I mean, not severe mental problems, but just there's something that they are dealing with themselves. Maybe they don't have sufficient self-confidence, or your boss may not have a good image of themselves, or maybe they are pressured by something. You can fill in the blanks. Yeah, when people get annoyed with you, it's always some problem they have themselves. And of course, in Buddhism, we even have the idea that any kind of anger or ill will is what we call a defilement. It's always something, a problem with the person who gets angry. This is why the Buddha said that anger is never removed through anger, or don't respond to anger with anger. He said that in the Dhammapada. But anger is always removed through love. And that is an eternal law, he said. Dhammapada, somewhere in the beginning of the Dhammapada, I think. I'm quoting it very badly, but that's basically what the Buddha said. Again, opening the door of your heart. Yeah? It's like you realize that people, like the crocodile who had a bad tooth, people have bad have bad tooth in a way. They have their own problems they're dealing with, and they're sort of reflecting that on you. So it happens very rarely, but when somebody in a monastery gets annoyed with me, I never think, yeah, the monks are really, really nice in the monastery, but it does sometimes happen that people get angry as well. We are not perfect as all of the monks, so. But then I never go and get upset in return with that monk, or I also never go and think, oh, maybe it's right what they said. Am I really a bad monk? No, I never think those kind of things. I just realize, okay, they've got something they're dealing with right now, and they're just sort of venting it or whatever. And I just happen to be there at that time. Yeah. It's just like the crocodile with the bad tooth. So then you just try to be like the mouse and realize that the problem is not with the person themselves even. It's just something they're dealing with. And that also opens the way for compassion as well. Because you realize people get angry because they're hurting inside in some way or the other. So angry people actually deserve a lot of compassion because they're suffering. It's not the happy people you have to have the compassion for. They're happy already. It's the angry people that need the compassion. So yeah. When people invade other people's countries, it's because they have something problem in with themselves. So we need compassion for those people as well who are invading, as well as the people who are invaded, of course. We need to have compassion for them all. That's quite a nice story, actually. I should look up who wrote it, the story of the crocodile. And maybe copyrighted, I don't know. So I don't know if you could put it in a book, but it is a nice story to tell. Yeah, it's a kid's story, of course, but it has a lot of wisdom in it as well. It's very similar to some of the Jataka stories. I don't know if you know the Jataka stories are stories which they say are the Buddha in a past life, but it's pretty obvious that that is not really, really true. But because many of the stories are just folkloric tales, about many of them are about animals. And then they tell this story. For example, let's say the crocodile story was from the Jatakas. Then they would tell this story and then they would say, the Buddha in his past life was the mouse, of course. And the crocodile was Devadatta. Something like that. That's what they would add to the Jataka stories. But the stories themselves are just very general stories like this. And then they sort of add it on later that it would supposedly be the Buddha. But that's how they found their way into the Buddhist canon. Some of the stories in here are also based on the Jatakas, I think. I vaguely recall. Which ones would they be? Can anybody help me out with that, maybe? I think there may be some. Some references in the back, actually, I remember now. Oh yeah, so in the end, footnote 8 and 9 say two stories are based on the Jatakas. But where's 8 and 9? That would be difficult to find. Yeah, and won't go looking through them all now. But there's some stories based on the Jatakas as well. They're really quite nice, the Jataka tales. Maybe the one from the talkative tortoise, maybe, is one from the Jataka tales. That's page 141. Who remembers the talkative tortoise story? Yeah. Anybody who does not know the talkative tortoise story? the talkative tortoise story. I'll just, I think it's too long to read it all out now because we have to. Yeah. Did it help? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Maybe use the microphone.
It's definitely got a very. It's got a wisdom to it. That's for sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it is from the Jatkas. Doesn't matter. It's a nice story anyway. So just in brief, for those who don't know. There's a tortoise living in a lake in the mountains. And the tortoise is a very talkative tortoise. It's always talking and talking about, ah, oh, look at this nice lake. It's a really nice lake I've got here. By the way, did you remember yesterday when we were going to visit the mouse and the angry crocodile, and that the mouse solved the problem of the angry crocodile, and blah, 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 the talkative tortoise. Everybody... All the other animals were like, ah, and we finally got rid of this crocodile and now we've got this tortoise to deal with. But the talkative tortoise was always living in the lake, and you know tortoises can't really travel very much, they're very slow. One day two very kind swans came, land in the lake, they didn't usually live there. And the tortoise says, hey, hello, swans, how are you doing? This is my home here, this lake. And by the way, watch out for the angry crocodile in the river next door because he may get another bad tooth. And I like that you come here. How did you fly all the way over here? Did you take Qantas or how did you come here? And the two swans are like, oh, this is a very talkative tortoise. They realized straight away. And the tortoise says, oh, where did you come from? And the swans told about all their flying. They came all the way from Africa, and they told about all the countries they've seen. And the tortoise says, well, that's really nice. Well, I've got this lake here, you know, and I can go under that rock there and again there. But those countries sound nice as well. Then the swan said, oh, well, you can come with us. But it's going to be hard to carry you, though. What should we do? And then the tortoise said, well, maybe if we take that stick over there and both of you take one end of the stick in your beak and I will bite in the middle of the stick and then you take off and I will just hold on like that. I shouldn't bite in a microphone. But you can imagine what was going on, like this. Tortoise holding on, and then we can fly back to Africa. Okay, said the swans, if that's what you want to do, we can take you to Africa, that's no problem. Now, they did what the tortoise suggested. They took the stick, one swan one end, one swan the other end, tortoise in the middle, flop, 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 and they took off. In the air and higher and higher and higher and higher. And the tortoise had trouble looking down because he was hanging like this, but he could see the lake disappearing in the distance. And they grew higher and higher. But of course, the swans beforehand had said, tortoise, remember, don't talk while you are in the air. But you can imagine what the talkative tortoise did. He said, yes, yes, I promise. Although he did not exactly realize what he had promised. We tortoises always keep our promises. In fact, I remember promising to the rabbit to try and be quiet a few days ago, and I told him about all the different type of tortoise shells and so on. But they flew higher and higher, and the lake grew smaller and smaller. Even the huge mountains seemed tiny. And the tortoise was carefully trying to remember it all. So, of course, later he could tell everybody about it, about everything that he saw and experienced. Then, after a while, they passed over a school where the children had just come out. A small boy happened to look up and said, "Wow, look at that stupid flying tortoise." And the tortoise couldn't stop himself. "Who are you calling? Oh, oops, stupid!" Splat! Oh, went the talkative tortoise as he crashed to the ground. And that was the last sound he made. And then is actually footnote that it is a jatkatil. The talkative tortoise died because he couldn't keep his mouth shut when it really mattered. So, if you don't learn how to keep quiet at proper times, then when it is important, you will not be able to keep your mouth shut. You might end up as a hamburger patty, like the talkative tortoise. Of course, teaching us about the value of silence. Because we always think, if we say something, we approve upon a situation somehow or the other. Or when we are in a conversation and we think, there's this phrase called awkward silence, we think we always have to fill the silence with words. But it's not true, actually. You can always share silence as well. There's a lot of wisdom in silence. The Dhamma, the Buddha taught, he said, it's beyond thinking, beyond the intellect. He said that very often, the Buddha. Because through words, through thinking, even through talks, even through stories, we only get at the surface level of the Dhamma. All these stories are really nice, but if you want to go really deep, you have to be really, really quiet. That's where the real Dhamma is hiding, inside of us, inside of the mind. When the mind gets really, really still, no thinking at all, no moving about, that's when the real deep Dhamma is found. And that's basically what this story is saying, although it doesn't say it explicitly. It's what is implied in it as well. Brings you back to the meditation again. So that is the talkative tortoise story. And of course you told it to your son, not with the ideas of meditation in mind, but just to the value of silence. And my parents also said that I used to be a very talkative kid as well. So maybe they should have had this story back then as well. My parents, when I was a talkative kid, had something else, by the way, to keep me quiet. And it was a game. And the game was called 1, 2, 3, we start now. That was the name of the game. And whenever somebody in our household said, 1, 2, 3, we start now, the aim was to keep quiet the longest. And whoever kept quiet the longest, they would win the game. My father always won, always. My mother usually lost first because she forgot about the game after 5 minutes or so. Then it was usually me because I was always talkative with my parents. And this is why the game was there in the first place, of course, to keep me shut for a while, especially during dinner. So I usually lost second, and then my brother and my father used to always win. But I remember this one time when my father, when I actually was winning, and for the whole dinner time, I was managed to keep quiet after the 1, 2, 3, we start now. I stayed quiet all the time. Then I went back up to my bedroom and stayed quiet over there as well. But my father, he just could not give me the victory that even that one time. You know what he did? He came up to my bedroom handed me the phone, and he gave me the phone, and I was like, "Hello, who's there?" And then he was like, "Ah, you lost." Yeah, you spoke. Well, I should have kept silent. I'm talking about keeping silent, I got the this sign from the back. It's time for us to be silent now as well. Maybe one quick comment or questions that still you've seen.
I just wanted to say thank you. It's a bit of art imitating life, dare I say. But just if people are still around at 5 o'clock, we have the Kalyana Friendship Community. And maybe Venerable Sumito, you might want to join Venerable Sanyo. Oh, wrong way round.
Yeah, I won't be here.
Tell more tales.
Yeah, maybe Venerable Sumito has some tales. I have to go back to the monastery because I need to recite the Patimokkha, the monk's rules there. Yeah. I was intending to be here for Vesak, but can't do. Anyway, thank you all for coming. Thank you for listening online. And I highly recommend those people who haven't read the book yet, Opening the Door of Your Heart. It's also called Truckload of Dung. Try to get your hands on it. It's very, very nice. Let's all say sadhu to this book. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.